The Return of Sherlock Holmes. Foreword by Stephen Fry. When Arthur Conan Doyle completed The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes in 1893, Queen Victoria still reigned after nearly 60 years on the throne. But Sherlock Holmes, his great hero, the character for whom he will primarily be remembered, had become a millstone around his author's neck. In the last story of that collection, called with what he had hoped was literal finality, The Final Problem, Conan Doyle had killed Sherlock Holmes off, and fervently hoped now to be able to devote himself to the historical novels that he loved, and which he felt better displayed his considerable, and perhaps overlooked, literary talents. "I must save my mind for better things," is how he had put it in a letter to his mother. But the public were not about to allow their favourite literary hero to disappear. In a national, indeed international, outburst that foreshadowed some of the distress that was to afflict the television-watching world when favourite characters in soaps and dramas were to be killed off, people, grown-up, adult, Victorian men and women, were seen going about wearing black armbands as tokens of lamentation and mourning for the great detective. Intense pressure was put on Conan Doyle to bring Sherlock Holmes back. This Doyle did, reluctantly but with enormous success, 8 years later in the full-length novel The Hound of the Baskervilles. But he did not bring Holmes back to life in this story. Instead, he had Watson relate an adventure that came before Holmes's death struggle with Moriarty in The Final Problem. This fix wasn't enough for the addicted public, however. Everywhere Conan Doyle went, he found himself being pestered for more Holmes. In the end, of course, it was the financial lure that caught him. Successful as his two best historical novels were, Micah Clarke and The White Company, they brought in nothing like the revenue that Holmes had yielded. So Conan Doyle bowed to the inevitable, took up his pen, and worked his magic. Sherlockians the world over still call the 12-year period between the last sentence of The Final Problem and the first sentence of The Return the Great Hiatus. How much happened in between, and what a year was 1905. The old queen, 4 years dead, the Titanic under construction in Belfast, revolution in Russia and mutiny on the battleship Potemkin, Freud writing on the Oedipus complex, crowds flocking to see moving picture exhibitions, Picasso in the midst of his blue period, the Ford Motor Company already 2 years old, Einstein publishing his paper on the special theory of relativity, including the equation E equals MC squared, literary modernism emerging, the Wright brothers managing to keep an airplane in the air for over half an hour, and in the midst of all this 20th century turbulence, the arch-Victorian detective making his spectacular comeback in a collection of 13 short stories published under the title, which must have come as such sensationally, shockingly good news at the time, The Return of Sherlock Holmes. It is fascinating to speculate how much Conan Doyle subconsciously left room for Holmes's resuscitation when he left him at the end of The Final Problem, apparently lying dead at the bottom of the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland, alongside his mortal enemy, Professor Moriarty. It does not feel too difficult, contrived, or far-fetched when Holmes explains in the opening story of the collection, The Adventure of the Empty House, how he had in fact survived. If Conan Doyle had really, really quite sincerely wanted his hero dead, he could have left his body to be discovered by a bereft Watson, and no comeback would ever have been possible. As it is, happily for his millions of admirers, Holmes was able convincingly to return, and in fact there were now to be more short stories written between the publication of this book and the very last collection than in the whole period before. The Return shows the author at the height of his powers, in my view. As well as the menacing figure of Colonel Sebastian Moran in the opening story, we meet other memorable villains, some of the nastiest in the canon, in fact, the odiously reptilian Charles Augustus Milverton, whom Holmes calls the worst man in London, the repulsively mean and vengeful Jonas Oldacre, builder of Norwood, and the loathsome, drunk and lecherous Mr. Woodley from The Solitary Cyclist spring to mind. The story called The Dancing Men is a much-loved classic, which in my case ignited a lifelong love of codes and cryptography. A school friend and I devised our own equivalent of the sinister matchstick men cipher in that story, with which we exchanged notes, much to the bafflement of our teachers. The adventure of the Priory School has always been a firm favourite of mine, too. I especially enjoy the closing moments in which Holmes names the criminal and receives his greatest ever fee. The final story in the collection, The Second Stain, was one which Conan Doyle himself most especially liked. He called it his eighth best story. It's rather endearing to think that he might have kept a top 10 list. A significant number of the adventures are referred to by Watson as having taken place some time ago, perhaps out of nostalgia for that period of gaslight and horse-drawn hansom cabs, which will always seem Holmes's proper milieu. But all the stories, I'm sure you will agree, justify completely Conan Doyle's bowing to public pressure and reviving his immortal hero the way he did. The variety of human life, the ingenuity of crime and detection, the brilliance and unique breadth and depth of the detective work, these are as fresh, vivid, and compulsively enjoyable today as they were well over a century ago. And so we welcome Mr. Sherlock Holmes back to life. How we wish he were with us still.